This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 27th of January 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 120th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bounds. Well, what do you got? We've got a lively mix-up of all the things we've been thinking about this week. Here's the rundown. We'll be asking Radiohead's Colin Greenwood why the UK's independent music venues need a helping hand.
The best nights, like 9 out of 10 times, and you don't really feel like it. And you go, off, yeah, sorry, I'll go out. And you go out and you see this thing happen before your eyes. This performance, you had no expectations. And you had a great night, and those are the best nights, and those are the best places to see those nights.
We'll get a report from independent film's finest new runners and riders with a roundup from the Sundance Film Festival.
We're here to be a part of this incredible artistic scene that gathers here for film and TV and bring a musical aspect to it and just sort of enlighten the mood.
And we'll learn what's sold and who is upsetting the apple cart at this year's Art Stage Singapore, Asia's first big fair of 2014.
We've had several $100,000 worth of sales. For that to happen the first time you come to a fair is unheard of, really. So we're over the moon. We could not be happier.
Plus, we'll get a window into which will be the bands of tomorrow with a summary of the Eurosonic Music Conference in Holland. And just in case we forgot what a resonant tune sounded like, we'll be treated to a session from the great Peggy Sue playing from their wonderful new album, live here at Midori House. That's all coming up here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. First to our live and exclusive Midori House session, supplied this week by Brighton come Londoners Peggy Sue, whose new album, Choir of Echoes, is released this week. They're back with a stronger sound, inspired partly by going on the road with Jack White and learning from his swagger. Here they are first with And Always Is. That was Peggy Sue with And Always Is from their live session here at Monocle Towers. More from them and a chat with Rosa and Katie from the band a little later. First, Wither, the independent music venue. Radiohead's Colin Greenwood will explain all. This week is Independent Venues Week in the UK, an initiative and series of gigs arranged across the country to promote the richness, diversity, beauty, and let's face it, sometimes sticky carpets of Britain's independent music venues. The corporate world is creeping into the ownership and running of venues, no surprise there. Live music is big business, in rude health, we're told. But what of the independent, smaller palaces of pop, casbahs of rock, arenas for electronica? Places where the singular visions of folk with an ear attuned to a certain style, or the local community, want to do the business putting on live music. One man whose band has benefited from their local venue, in this case Oxford's Jericho Tavern, is Colin Greenwood, bassist for Radiohead. Colin came into Midori House to talk live, local, and why it matters.
One of the most important things is that we should give attention and respect to the individuals, the brave men and women of the gig scene who put on the shows, who curate, who put together a bill of local bands, perhaps on a Thursday night with a promotion. They helped shape my life and our life as a band in Oxford. And they're all over in all the country and still working and putting on great shows for the community, as I said, local bands and also further afield.
Your big break came at the Jericho Tavern,
yeah,
in Oxford, which is presumably a place you played a few times before that fateful night when you got signed after the gig.
Yeah.
Tell us about that. I'd love to know a bit about that. That obviously still exists.
Yeah,
that's one of the places that I think you're putting on a night there during this independent venue week.
That's right.
Tell us about the vibe there when you guys first started to play it and maybe how it's changed, if it has.
How has it changed? They haven't put any kind of lifts or made it any easier to like lug out amplifiers up the back stairs. It's pretty much the same. There used to be a shocking mural on the round the corner at the top room with like up of us and Supergrass and maybe some other local rock luminaries. But thank God someone's painted it over.
They were trying to support a local artist.
Yeah, I don't know. But it's pretty much the same as when we first staggered up there in like 19. Well, the first gig we did was 87, you know, before we were called Radiohead and we were called On a Friday and there were two other bands on the bill, but they were the same band, they just changed their name. And
that's clever.
You know, it's very clever. It was very good. Yeah. But the guy who promoted it, who did the sounds, this guy called Mac, who is like this amazing character who, you know, gave us our break, famously punched one of the guys from Birdlands and broke his nose because he was trashing the gear. So you wouldn't mess with Mac, but he gave local bands a chance and a break, you know, and he also got like really cool bands to come and play there, like Pulp, Primal Scream, Giant Sand, Jonathan Richman. And, you know, listening to all these bands who are going to be playing at the end of the month in Oxford at the Jericho, what struck me is like just the diversity of styles and influences, you know. I suppose it could have been the same in the 90s too. It was probably a bit more raucous, but there sort of seems to be 80s flavours coming through now. So I think that's exciting. You know, I think you should celebrate the fragmentation of taste that seems to be happening with like all these new artists.
And that's an amazing thing that just some of the names you've mentioned there clearly went on to great things, and even the ones that didn't clearly made the scene exceptionally interesting and rich and diverse.
Yeah.
You mentioned Mac, the guy at the Jericho Tavern in Oxford who booked you.
That's right.
Presumably people are attracted to play at, even if they've got a fairly personal and unprofessional door policy.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
People want to play for people like that, don't they? They want to get behind. They want to kind of feel a bit of the vibe of a place like that.
That's right. Yeah, he famously, around 30 A&R men came to see us play in the summer of like 91. He made them all pay. We played his birthday party and we did like a sort of medley of Hooked on classics and sort of as a sort of tribute to him and his booking skills. Fantastic.
Booking skills. Yeah. The man with the red telephone.
That's right, yeah.
Obviously, musicians want to give something back to the venues that they were broken at and all the rest of it. But what about fans? Do fans care as much, do you think, about not just the venues, but who's behind them?
Yeah, what's going on and how it's being set up. I think the most important, precious thing about this whole independent venue thing is, and going supporting your local gigs, is turning up for a night out and not knowing what you're going to see. And in a world where everything is so programmed and set up and arranged via a series of Google-sponsored algorithms and predictive clicking, I think it's fantastic to go and watch an act that you may not know much about and see them play, you know, 2 metres in front of you, you know, 3 feet up on a beer crate stage or whatever, and witness like the scene and the buzz and the excitement of a night out where it's unknowns, you know, not something like Rumsfeld, but it's like you don't know what's, you know, we know what you're going to see, you know.
Of all the people in the world, yeah, I didn't think that you'd be quoting Donald Rumsfeld.
I know. Got to drag him in somewhere. But I think that's fantastic, you know, and the best night, you know what it's like when your mate calls you up and says, do you want to go out tonight and see this band? And you know, the best nights, like 9 out of 10 times, and you don't really feel like it. And you go off, yeah, sod it, I'll go out. And you go out and you see this thing happen before your eyes, this performance. They had no expectations and you had a great night. And those are the best nights and those are the best places to see those nights.
It's UK-based at the moment, but I think it's wouldn't mind spreading its wings internationally, I guess.
Yeah, I think, well, for Radiohead, when we started, we played a whole bunch of independent places in America. Mm-hmm. It was like a passport to all the towns and cities that we visited, you know, in the same way that, you know, all the clubs that are still going strong in the UK, like Southampton Joiners and Jericho Tavern. You know, I love the names of these places, the Princess Charlotte, the Duchess, the Adelphi. They all like sort of bespeak of exotic evenings, you know, or in post-industrial urban town, you know, like Jericho Tavern set in this sort of terrace row houses. It was all the accommodation for the Lucy Leather Tanning Factory, and the Jericho is in Walton Street or in Oxford, which is also part, used to be famed for being old red light district. So, you know, all these places, it's just a fantastic connection with the history of the places, but also like going forward with like the next generation of fans and supporters, you know, exciting, sharing live music.
And I guess the ghosts of some of the greats that have gone before you in some of these places as well, right? When you're in a scrappier dressing room, at least you're kind of going, man, you know, at least, as I say, Jonathan Richman played here, you know, all these people that went before you. That must be a nice...
Primal Scream, and Primitives. I mean, so many people. And, you know, going back to my friend Mac, he was the first guy who put on the White Stripes and the Strokes in Oxford, their first shows. So, you know, it's like everyone wants to check out what the next big thing's going to be, when it's going to be coming down the road. And you can do that by going to your local gig and seeing what's coming up. Just look at the flyers, look online, check it out and go.
Colin Greenwood, bassist for Radiohead, voice of Independent Venue Week. Thank you so much for your time today. Cheers.
Pleasure.
Well, Independent Venue Week is a UK-wide event running all this week. And if you want to find out more, just visit independentvenueweek.com. So where are the best music venues in your city? Well, we asked some of our global team of reporters to get out there and visit some of the places keeping their local music scene alive. First up, down to Melbourne, where Adrian Craddock met with Tyson Ray, associate music editor at music magazine Beat, to visit Tyson's favourite venue in the city.
I'm Tyson Ray, I edit Beat magazine, which is basically a Melbourne music and arts culture magazine.
And can you tell me where we are right now?
Currently in the heart of the Melbourne CBD, sitting two floors up in the smoky area of the Toffin Town, which is a lovely little venue in Swanston Street, Melbourne. I believe it must have been back in about 2009 when I had first moved to Melbourne. I read about a gig of a band called My Disco. They were playing here, so I took my young country self up the stairs of the Curtain House and found myself in somewhere I would spend basically most Saturdays and Friday nights of my next 6 years. When you walk in, you're walking in on Swanston Street, which is on the corner just off Lonsdale, and so much traffic, and the moment you turn around that first corner, it's all just hushed out. You walk up, you can hear sort of the more bass lines from the support acts or the DJs that are playing in the carriage room. And once you get up the top, you open those soundproof doors and it all just comes flooding into you. Inside is all you've done. I could want for no other to share. As far as bands go, what are your fondest memories of this place? Oh, without a doubt, the first that comes to mind would be a sweet little Sunday night gig last year where a local musician called Wintercoats, I believe his real name is James Wallace, and he's a multi-instrumentalist who mainly plays his violin and uses a lot of loop pedals, also incorporates piano, glockenspiel, keyboard, basically whatever he's got. And He's a real up-and-coming Melbourne musician who's really never caught my attention like anyone else on a first viewing. The Toff definitely appeals to a different demographic than, say, The Corner or The Esplanade. Those are very much more heavy rock orientated, where I think you'll find The Corner more indie, more pop, more post-rock, more ambient. They won't ever really have the sort of hard rock, you know, balls-to-the-wall rock that you'll find at, say, the ESPY on a Saturday night. Either here, with the loss of the East Brunswick Club and the Gasometer in recent months, the Toff has really been a go-to for almost any band of somewhat stature in Australia.
That was Tyson Ray sharing the joys of Melbourne's Toff in Town venue, next to Belgrade, where reporter Guy Delaney picked out the Gun Club.
My name is Igor Gligorov. I'm a music lover from Belgrade, and my favorite venue in Belgrade is Gun Club. I like it first because of the atmosphere, then because they bring interesting bands to play from abroad and from region, from ex-Yugoslavia, and also some local bands from Belgrade. During the day, it's actually a place to go to shooting. So I think the owner had some good arrangement with the owner of the shooting range. During the night, it become like underground music place. Around 300 people can fit in. It's completely relaxed. It doesn't matter how you are clothed or how you're acting. You can do whatever you want there. There's a certain, like, we could say, core of fans, and they had a lot of affection for Gun Club. Because there are a lot of interesting bands who plays. Because in Gun Club, it doesn't matter if you play jazz, or you play punk, or you play psychobilly, or whatever, you can play there. I think this is the important thing. I saw Bambi Molesters, it's a Croatian surf rock group. Goribor. It's a Serbian group. Audience who doesn't go to arena and other big venues, they're actually going to Gun Club, following the bands who are playing there. We had a Gitter Wolf, a Japanese noise band, playing there last year. And although it was only maybe 50 or 100 people there, in audience, I think it was one of the best cultural events in Serbia last year, and it was in Gun Club. I think it's important because, you know, like, mainstream culture needs to have at least one place in the city of 2 million, like one underground place, so where you can see something different.
That was Igor Gligorov speaking to Guy Delaney at the Gun Club in Belgrade. And finally to New York, where Pauline Eiferman took a trip down to Death by Audio in Brooklyn.
I'm Eden Wilbur. I book all the shows and do all the sound at Death by Audio. It's a venue in Brooklyn, New York. It's just kind of a small space, two rooms. We do about like 200 people maximum shows. It's got a pretty killer PA, and you know, we just try to pack it in, try to have shows that are interesting to me, because I'm the one who has to watch the show, so I need to make sure it's something that I want to see at least. I feel like that I, in my booking, offer something. Like, I think that's the difference, is that I take a lot of care in my booking because I do all steps of the process, and I try to make it something that I would really enjoy, so hopefully other people would too. And if I'm going to be there, you know, hopefully people are going to be there with me. I tend to go towards like a heavier rock vein, but like we do all kinds of music here, like all different genres. And like there's, and like it's not to say I just like heavy music. I like all kinds of things, but I'd say I prefer that. Like I'd prefer to see that live. It's tends to be more interesting than like a singer-songwriter type situation. And it's really cool to see that in New York, there's always a lot of great bands like starting out, and and you know, a lot of great touring bands just like doing their own tours, just grassroots, and it's really cool to help them out, give them a show. I mean, there's definitely been a handful of bands that have played here. I don't know like how huge anybody is, but like Jeff the Brotherhood definitely played a lot of their first shows here. Ty Siegel played his first show in New York here. Shane and the Clams played their first show in New York here. A lot of great acts. The OCs played here all the time. You know, all kinds of weird things. We just had Ardo Lindsay from DNA do like a noise quartet. It's a lot of fun. Just come down and see a show. You probably see something you enjoy. It's probably not something you know, but try something new. It's probably something you might like.
Thanks,
Jeff. A trip to Death by Audio in Brooklyn, finishing our global tour of local independent music venues. You're tuned in to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. From New York, we'll be hopping over to Utah next for a bit of skiing and a screening or two. It is Sundance time.
Monaco has shops around the world selling our exclusive collaborations with some of our favourite designers, including Ettinger, Porter, Barenna, Jawbone, Oliver Peoples, and many more. You can find us on College Street in Toronto, Hudson and Charles in New York, and in the heart of Wan Chai in Hong Kong, and two in London. So, whether you're after a versatile travelling wardrobe, something for the home, or a present for a loved one, or just missing back issues from your collection, you're sure to find something at the Monaco shop.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. Well, January has come to mean one thing for independent filmmakers. Once the New Year celebrations have subsided, most of them just cross through the whole month in their diary and simply write Sundance. It's hard to believe that the event is now celebrating its 30th birthday, but for the last 10 days, filmmakers, buyers and fans have been gathered in Utah for one hell of a party. And while the film still takes centre stage, the roster of events, talks and subcultures just keeps on growing, as James Nelson found out when he went to pay Sundance 2014 a visit.
When the Sundance Film Festival started back in the 1980s, Main Street here in Park City, Utah, was not filled with filmmakers, directors, or really many people at all. But that early, slow start did not sway Robert Redford. And now, 30 years later, the streets are busy, full of energy. It's very difficult to find a place to park. Paparazzi are around almost every corner, and the Sundance Film Festival is now considered to be one of the very best in all the world.
On Main Street. We had a section.
The festival always starts out at the Egyptian Theater on Park City's Main Street, not with the movie, but with Robert Redford and a few friends, on stage for a few words about how it all started 3 decades ago.
And share the work with each other. Maybe if we were lucky, somebody else might come. But that's as far as we had planned. We did not know or expect anything after that.
Then the pace picks up for more than a week. Fashion, stars, buzz, and energy in the air. 117 feature films from 37 countries, 54 of those films from first-time directors. At one of the many parties for the movie stars, directors, and cast members, Elizabeth Banks was all smiles as she posed for pictures and chatted about a film premiere she stars in with a first-time film director. It's called Little Accidents. Banks describes the journey filmmakers make to the big screen.
I do. I have a little film called Little Accidents. It's about the aftermath of a mining accident in a West Virginia mining town, and amazing script. I really think the writer-director, Sarah Colangelo, is one of these world-class writers. But you will hear her name again and again.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, and go, AJ.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to Hollywood. Today, coming to you live from the Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah. I'm AJ Gibson.
A Hollywood-style movie studio broadcasting film buzz high atop a Main Street hotel. It's the brainchild of energetic Ron Bloom. What he describes is part of the Sundance landscape now.
Most people think that the future of internet is streaming. We have a streaming component, but we think the future of the internet is entertainment. So we picked up the entire studio and brought 40 people here. And you can see it, a full set. We're at 1,500 square feet on the fourth floor of the Sky Lodge, really in the heart of Heber and Maine, where the Sundance Film Festival is. And instead of running up and down the street with a head and a microphone, we're really bringing the celebrities to us, the filmmakers, and we're letting the audience chime in. We have thousands of viewers online at any time, moving towards hundreds of thousands who are asking questions.
At the Sundance House, a fun, hands-on way to see how filmmaking works. You pick up the receiver of a big blue phone, listen to some instructions, and then head downstairs, where we found New York artist Louis Navarro.
Received today at 9:26 p.m.
Hello, I'm Helen, and I'm from London, and I'm looking forward to coming back to Sundance this year. Thanks, bye.
Someone upstairs left us a message, and then we got it down here. We edited it and make sure that it was short enough, and then we started animated. So he draws on the chalkboard, frame by frame. We take a picture, like stop motion animation. We take a frame, put it on the computer. Then on the computer we make the animation, so it looks like what you just saw. And then he sends it to me here, which I do the edit. So I cut it and put the sound together with it. Then we drop those animations into the YouTube channel in HP. We also put them on the TV that is under the phone, so you can see them there.
Well, it shows, Louis, how fast animation and creation can happen. A phone call. Pick up the phone, call it in, say what you want.
We still do about 1.5 a day, almost 2.
Great, exciting part of the film industry.
Yes, it is.
Of course, there is plenty of music all around during Sundance. Spencer Ludwig is a trumpeter player for Capital Cities.
We're here to be a part of this incredible artistic scene that gathers here for film and TV and bring a musical aspect to it and just sort of enlighten the mood. And it's really an honor to be a part of it. We were here last year, we're here again, and I mean, to come back here and be a part of like the snow and the sun and the snow in the same place to me is like my favorite place to be. So it inspires good music, inspires good vibes. And, you know, it's just a really cool environment where you see celebrities walking around and it's just sort of like casual and everyone can be cool with each other.
Of course, there's plenty of entertainment during Sundance, but in the end, it's about the filmmakers. On a bus ride to a screening of her work on the film Young Ones, producer Bridget Olean talked about the festival experience.
I think it's a thrilling occasion. I think to be amongst many filmmakers and artists is a wonderful opportunity. I think South Africa is a little isolated from the rest of the world, so this gives us a platform and a forum, which I think is fantastic.
What about connecting with other filmmakers and other people in the industry at Sundance?
Yeah, this is the place to do it. You know, this is the connector. So we've been part of a South African delegation that was launched by the Cape Film Commission and approved by the DTI, and it's given us access to filmmakers' lounges and panels and discussions and the best thing possible.
Sugar can hide behind many names on nutrition labels like sucrose, fructose, glucose, dextrose, lactose, maltose, invert sugar, and turbinado sugar.
An unofficial motto of sorts for upcoming filmmakers, whatever your film story is, one of the best places to share it is here at Sundance. For Monocle, in Park City, Utah, I'm James Nelson.
Thank you, James. And Sundance has wrapped up for this year, but if you want to catch up on the headlines, just visit sundance.org/festival. Well, there's plenty more to come in part two. Peggy Sue will provide the musical accompaniment, of course. We'll explore one of the most monitored art markets in the world as we see what sold and who are the personalities at this year's Art Stage Singapore and ask what acts we should be paying attention to at the Eurosonic Music Conference in Groningen. I said Groningen. Time first for another track from a great full bore live session from our band this week, Peggy Sue. After an album of rock covers, they're back this week with Choir of Echoes that boosts the firepower of their rather more folky sound. Their new is a thing of harmonies, Americana, widescreen songs, like a road trip to the land of breakups and makeups. Before I asked Rosa and Katie from the band about where their slight change of tack came from, they played this, Longest Day of the Year Blues.
When we quit where we started out, we were both of us the same. I wish that I was changed. I know you're sorry, baby. I know that you tried. Or at least you tried to try. You should have seen me working. I kept straight face. Oh, the long day. You should have seen me working. I was balanced like the plates. Oh, the long day.
I'm here with Rosa and Katie from Peggy Sue, who just did a beautiful session for us out there, aided and abetted by a bit of a rhythm section. And you sounded fantastic.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for it. It's got a muscularity that the record before it lacked a bit. I say lacked. It was a different record.
It was different this muscles. Different
muscles.
It was more
what
like
muscles are you using for this one that you didn't use for the other one?
Arms and legs rather than, I don't know, some kind of girly muscles.
Girly muscles.
The heart or something. The heart and the lungs.
There's plenty of muscles there to be getting on with.
Yeah, true.
Let's talk about the new record. It's got a different sound to it. As I said, it's maybe a bolder thing. What have you been listening to different things when you were writing it? Because I know you toured with Jack White and various
different
people
yeah.
as well. Does that sort of stuff rub off?
I think it probably does. Watching, he's so rock and roll, yeah. and they're so. I don't think it was a conscious thing. After we did record it quite soon after, and maybe it makes you want to be a bit fuller.
Yeah.
And he's so macho,
right.
and so like I'm rocking out, and I'm so it's so timeless.
Yeah.
So maybe that had a bit of an influence, but more consciously, we made a covers album the year before,
yeah.
called Peggy Sue Play the Songs of Scorpio Rising, which is all these rock and roll covers that are the soundtrack to a Kenneth Anger film, and that was probably the biggest like conscious influence on the new album, that those pop structures and hooks and choruses yeah. and backing vocals and all that stuff. So we brought some of that in.
Because I was going to ask you about the lyrics. Some of them sound rather heartbreaking. There's some breakup songs on the record. They're okay. You're sort of steeled against the emotion of the song by having a bit more of a driving rhythm.
Yeah, I think so. And I think even the ones which have got heartbreak in them tend to have quite positive elements to them. Longest Day is a breakup song, but it's not taking itself too seriously.
I like the way, Katie, that you introduced that song when you played it for us. This is a breakup song, or this is a song about getting broken up with if you're a waitress and it's Longest Day of the Year. Presumably that no one's ever said that sentence in the English language before.
They might not have said it, but they might have thought it. Hopefully that's, I don't know, yeah, maybe not. That one is a bit of heartbreak, but it's not that bad, and you make it something cathartic, and you make it into something else and then you're like, well, cool, I got a good song out of that, so that's fine. And, and it wasn't, yeah, it's nice.
We've had a couple of people in this studio in the last couple of weeks who said exactly the same thing. We had Gregory Porter in and we had Boy George in last week, both of whom said, well, it's all right if you write a song. It's all right if you write, if someone breaks your heart, at least you get to write a song about it. And sometimes you even get nominated for a Grammy.
Nice. Well, next time.
Which is the silver lining, right? And it'd be nice to know where and when this album was made. Because I know you toured quite a lot, obviously, for the stuff before it. Was it made on the road or did you kind of all filter off and buzz off home and write it? How did it come about?
This is an album that was actually written in one room in quite a sort of considered way.
Although we'd tend to... About Rosa and I write about half the songs each, mm-hmm. and then we bring them to the rest of the band, and that's when they turn into being like, that's when they stop being like breakup songs and start being like good pop songs.
Right. So, okay. The self indulgence gets squeezed out a little
everyone's
bit.
Everyone's like, stop complaining. Yeah. Let's put a hook in.
Yeah, right.
So we will write them separately, and we've been writing them, I guess, all that time that we were touring after Acrobats came out. So some of the oldest ones are a couple of years old. And then we'll come to this one practice room that we have and we'll write them all there. But yeah, what Rosa was saying is it was so considered. We, for the first time, kind of knew what we wanted to do and hopefully achieved the thing that we were trying to do rather than having 20 songs and hoping that they fitted together properly.
That was Rosa and Katie from the band Peggy Sue. Their new album, Choir of Echoes, is out now, and they're touring the UK, US and Europe over the coming weeks and months. PeggyWho.com, yes who, not Sue, is your one-stop shop for all of the information on the band. We'll hear more from them again at the end of the show, but for now, you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Right off to Singapore now, where the annual Art Stage Fair took place recently, welcoming a record 46,000 people through its doors over 5 days. Coupled with promising sales figures, it's not bad for the fledgling event, which is only in its fourth year. And with an increasing number of fairs now taking place in the region, this year Art Stage Singapore upped the ante with a week of periphery events, which even saw recently released Russian protest rockers Pussy Riot flying into town for an awards ceremony. Well, we were keen to see how the fair itself has evolved, so we dispatched Carrie Noten to take the pulse between the booths. To kick things off, she spoke to fair director Lorenzo Rudolph.
I think this fourth edition is a milestone in the history of Art Stage and a milestone in the history of art fairs in Asia. What we surely see is that there is a momentum today regarding art from Southeast Asia. I think it has surely also to do with Art Stage, not only, but Art Stage is a catalyst for this entire region, and especially it's a catalyst which helps this region to go into the market, because Southeast Asia is very, very strong regarding its art scenes, its artists, but not very, very strong regarding its galleries, and that's the reason that they need also a platform like that. And that's something we see. And the other thing we see is that in Asia, and also in countries you never would think about, you see art coming and artists coming, which is not only classical painting, but really very, very conceptual. I discovered here artists from Myanmar. I was totally blown away how conceptual they think and work. They could have been coming from Brooklyn.
My name is Ikkan Sanada. I'm the owner of Ikkan Art Gallery based in Singapore. I'm specialized in international art, new media art, I should say, with digital art, video art, etc.
What kind of works are you selling here at Art Stage?
I'm showing Team Lab. It's an artist collaborative based in Tokyo, Japan. The image you are looking at is a waterfall made up with 5 high-resolution television. The waterfall image is infinite length. There is no beginning or no end.
Can you tell me a little bit, how is digital art going right now? Is it more and more popular?
Digital art is beginning to be accepted by most of the art lovers. It's still a very new territory. Traditional art collectors have difficult time understanding it, but when they see the actual work, they are mesmerized and they are so attracted. I can prove, because I sold so many of them here.
I'm Harry Hutchison. I work for Icon Gallery, and we are a gallery based in New York, and we represent artists from South Asia. At Art Stage Singapore, we decided to bring a third of the booth dedicated to modern masters, and two-thirds dedicated to contemporary. And it's our first year here, but we've seen real interest in both sections, and we've had several hundred thousand dollars worth of sales. And for that to happen in for the first time you come to a fair is unheard of, really. So we're over the moon. We could not be happier.
Can you show me a little bit of your modern art? Which of these works really like sold out very fast?
So we had one FN Souza and two MF Husseins sell on the first night. They're India's most famous and recognizable modern artists. And this Souza from 1956 was painted when he was in London, and it's part of the Harold Kovner collection, so a very prestigious collection. And this actually saw a bidding war, so it felt like we were an auction house rather than a gallery.
Who bought it in the end?
Who bought it? Well, I can't really tell you who bought it, but I can tell you that 90% of our collectors have some kind of connection to South Asia, whether they worked in India or their grandparents or their parents are Indian. They tend to be our collectors because they want to collect their own cultural heritage.
I'm Lito Camacho. I'm originally from the Philippines, but now living in Singapore. I'm here primarily as a collector. In this art fair, you see that conversation happening between Western artists and Asian artists. And I think you see both young as well as established artists from Asia, you know, having a chance to be this, you know, to be exhibited side by side. And so it just makes for a more exciting art fair, because, you know, there's a lot of new names coming up, but there's also a lot of old names.
Market-wise, can you tell us also if prices are still reasonable compared to other art fairs? What kind of progression have you seen for the last 4 years?
Well, it's because of the focus on Southeast Asia. Obviously, the art values that you're seeing here would not compare to, you know, Art Basel or Art Basel Miami, or even to some extent Art Week in Hong Kong, because of the focus on a particular type of art. And I think Southeast Asian art is still fairly young in the art world, but it's coming up very quickly. And some of the young contemporary artists of Southeast Asia, particularly places like the Philippines, Indonesia, are now commanding quite, you know, significant values. So I think it makes for excitement.
That was collector and banker Lito Camacho, former finance minister for the Philippines, speaking to Carrie Noton at Art Stage Singapore. And you're tuned into Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. On your bike, Groningen is the next stop.
Contemporary Czech designers are embracing age-old bohemian glassmaking traditions and mixing in new techniques to create modern products with soul. Monocle Films pays a visit to some of the country's most clear-thinking glass alchemists.
Original decoration, this is very difficult, and it must be about emotions. And if I'm teaching students, I'm speaking about mentality of glassmakers, that it's not good to be proud only. Artists must be humble too.
Clear vision, check glass. Now playing in the film section on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. Well, for those in film, January may all be about Sundance, but in the indie music scene, influencers and hopeful artists head to the Netherlands for the Eurosonic Music Conference. This time last year, we spoke to BBC Radio 1 DJ Hugh Stevens about his picks from the event, and this year we've turned to the Irish Times' Jim Carroll, a Eurosonic stalwart. 2014 is Jim's 10th year in attendance, and he met with reporter Barbara Feeney to give his thoughts on how this year's event fared in the Eurosonic canon.
I think this year at Eurosonic in Groningen, it was definitely a year of consolidation. Eurosonic has been going in Groningen since about 1999. It was originally a kind of an EBU travelling roadshow, and they set up permanent digs in Groningen in the late 1990s. I've been going for it for 10 years, and over that 10-year period, you can just see it growing in terms of profile and in terms of reach. I mean, it has become the hub for European festival bookers. If you are someone who's got a European festival coming up this summer, you're in Groningen in January in order to find bands who are going to fill your stages this summer. and that has become the most important part of Eurosonic for many, many people. In the last year or two, they've also kind of, I suppose, added a technology, I suppose, stream to things as well, that people who are involved in music tech startups are coming to Groningen to show off their wares and to meet like-minded souls. I don't think there's many VCs hanging around. There didn't seem to be much money as such, but like, there's just an awful lot of kind of innovation ideas. But obviously, maybe two or three years from now, the money will follow. In terms of the actual bands, I mean, they, in the last 10 years, they've doubled the bands. The first year I went, there was 178 bands playing. This year, there's 337 bands playing. The thing about Eurosonic is the bands are completely and utterly market ready. They can play so well. They've got their songs are right. Everything about the bands are completely right. And it's the way it should be, you know, because, I mean, you have the audience is composed like of locals. I mean, Groningen has got a huge live music fan base, mainly because it's a university town. Back in the 1950s, the local city of Fowlers passed an ordinance which basically granted late alcohol licenses to any clubs which had live music, hence why there's loads of live music clubs in Groningen.
Any particular names that stuck out to you, and perhaps some Irish names as well?
The best band I saw by far was, as always happens at these things, the very last band I saw, a band called Offgang from Luxembourg, Trio. They are classically trained. They all went to Juilliard, and they've got really good classical chops. But they play this mad mixture of kind of like, I suppose, classical techno and post rock. It was fantastic. They played in the old music hall, and it was just a great show to end it all with. They were kind of supposed to be one of my highlights. There's a Portuguese band called Pause. They were very impressive as well. There was a French singer called Christine and the Queens, basically one female singer and two backing voguing dancers, and that was really interesting kind of pop. In terms of the Irish bands, I mean, Irish bands have had a really good run at Eurosonic in the last couple of years with people like James Vincent, McMorrow, Villagers and Codeline, and I suppose the two Irish bands who stood out a mile this year for me were Dahi and Girl Band. Dahi is a youngster from the west coast of Ireland. He's a traditionally trained fiddle player. And what he's done is he's basically upped the ante by using a loop station and adding loads of kind of house beats to it. I mean, he started off as quite experimental, more Arthur Russell a couple of years ago, but he's definitely found his pop footing, and he's got an album ready to go. And his show was just amazing. He was like this whirling dervish on stage, and the crowd really got into it. And musically, the songs all have really, really strong pop radio-friendly hooks. So he was definitely one I'd be recommending.
And Jim, you mentioned to me before that you've been going to this for 10 years. Has it changed significantly in that time, or have you seen, you know, anything new emerge?
Over the last 10 years, what's happened is that its profile has really upped. When I first went there, most people were going to meet him in Cannes at the end of January rather than Eurosonic in Groningen. For a start, the weather is better in Cannes than it is in Northern Netherlands in January. That's a significant reason to go, I suppose, to South of France. And there wasn't as many deals being done. And what's happened, I suppose, is that Eurosonic has repivoted itself and has become more about the live business. And they've also got involved with a thing called the European Talent Exchange Programme, which is a way of using European Union money to help bands play at festivals all over the continent. And Eurosonic is kind of like the hub of that ETEB scheme. So that means that basically you've got more and more festivals coming in there. This year, there are representatives or bookers from 500 international festivals in Groningen. And that's significant. That's a big, big number of people. And that kind of shows, I suppose, Eurosonic's power, heft, and importance when it comes to live music in Europe right now.
Jim Carroll of the Irish Times talking to Barbara Feeney there. And with those musical recommendations ringing in our ears, that's all we have time for this week. Next week, we'll be sitting down with journalist John Savage to discuss his new film, Teenage, and plenty more besides. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Wilbur, and Holly Fisher bonded all together like a psychopath with a Pritt stick. Time for one final song this week from their Midori House session. This is Peggy Sue with Idol. Thanks for tuning in.
Let the devil my idle hands, let the devil make war for my idle hands, for I'm never such trouble as when I'm making plans. So let the devil make war for my idle hands. his bones. Let the devil find a place for these restless bones. Stop me swinging back and forth between the ones I already know. Let the devil find a place for these restless, restless truth.